Hello, I'm Dr. Ira Nash. Welcome to Well Said. We're living in a time where people are not just living longer, but redefining what it means to grow older. With advances in medicine, public health, and technology, the aging population is growing rapidly, and with that comes new challenges, new questions, and new opportunities. What does healthy aging actually look like? How can we support older adults to not just survive, but thrive in their later years? Today, we're exploring the reality of aging in America and what we need to do to prepare for a future where aging well is possible for more and more people. To help us understand the complexities and opportunities of an aging population, we're joined by Dr. Maria Carney. Dr. Carney has joined us several times on Well Said to talk about a variety of issues related to her two areas of expertise, geriatrics and palliative care. Dr. Carney is the inaugural director of the Institute for Aging in Northwell Health. She is also a professor of medicine at the Zucker School of Medicine at Hofstra Northwell. Maria, welcome back to Well Said.
Well, thank you very much for having me. I always enjoy this.
When we talk about an aging population, what do we actually mean by that? Why is that an important issue for us to be discussing right now?
It's a celebration of longevity. In 1800, life expectancy was about 45 years of age. Coincidentally, I just finished watching Gilded Age, right?
You and everyone else.
And everyone else, yeah. The lifespan was about 45 years of age. But now a child born in the year 2000 is expected to live to almost twice that, 85. There's some disparities on life expectancies, gender, race, ethnicities. But in general, we're talking about a celebration of longevity. And living longer means living with multiple conditions. As we live, we may get a condition, high blood pressure, diabetes, and we're able to manage it. But now we have a larger growing population with multiple conditions that is stressing our healthcare systems.
There's a lot there that you just said, and I want to pick apart a few things. So first, just kind of the statistical aspect of this. When we talk about people living longer on average, and you mentioned the early 1800s, the average lifespan was in the 40s. Wasn't most of that due to the fact that there were a lot of kids who died? And so if you average up, you know, people who died in infancy and before their first birthday with people living in their 60s, you know, it averages out to 30. Were there not people living to the ripe old age that you and I are back in those days?
They probably were. However, we're in a different set of situations now in that we're able to manage diseases quite well before they have end organ damage. We can delay that advanced illness state. But what's happened from the 1800s to now has been vaccinations, safe water, injury prevention,
public
health measures. And now modern medicine, we're getting knee replacements, right? That's keeping us mobile and active.
Yeah.
Cardiac treatments to prevent the heart attacks. Blood pressure management, statins, for example, have like really contributed to longevity. So we have faced modern medicine today like never seen before.
And when you use the word longevity, you're speaking strictly about age at death. You're not saying anything about the quality of that life. Is that correct?
Yes. And that's the goal for the next stage. We're really good in healthcare of managing diseases. We study people with diseases and how that impacts it. But we're not studying people with that disease and five other diseases.
Yeah. Yeah.
Right? So we don't necessarily know the holistic approach to managing people with multiple conditions.
Okay. So one more kind of statistical-ish kind of question. So as people enjoy the kinds of advances you're talking about, we have people living longer.
Yeah.
But if you take a snapshot of the entire population, how has the kind of percentage of older people shifted over time? So if you look at the country now, give us a little snapshot of how many old people are there and how old are they?
Yeah. And when we say older adults, we're talking in general a demographic population. Demographically, the CDC, the Census bureaus, they use 60 and older, 65 and older. That is an older adult demographic. It doesn't mean you're old.
Yeah,
right?
Well, people can't see my the look on my face when you said that.
It just means in perspective, you're in a demographic that is an older adult as opposed to a younger adult, 18 to 25. So just I want to set this straight. So we're not talking about getting old.
Okay.
The over 65 population is about 20-25% of the population. And we expect that to increase because the baby boomers who were born after World War II in the 40s are now entering that over 65 age group. We're beginning that increase in that population.
What you'd say roughly a quarter of the population is in
over
that,
65.
Over 65. How does that compare to what it looked like, I don't know, 50 years ago?
So for the first time in the U.S. history, the over 65 population will outnumber the under 18 population by 2034.
Okay.
So that's to give you an idea.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
We've never had that situation before in our history of our country.
And I assume from just the tenor of this conversation and what I know about your work, that percentage is going to continue to grow.
Hopefully.
Yeah.
You know.
What are the projections?
The projections are, we looked at our healthcare system at Northwell, our marketplace. We expect in the next 5 years, and that's a short period of time, our healthcare utilization will be increasing about 5-10% in the over 65 population, while under 65 is going to shrink.
That's a reflection of both the size of that population and the differences in their health needs.
Correct. In the next 10 years, we expect that to be 10-20% increase.
Wow. Those are substantial changes.
Yeah. So we're seeing 5 years, a little bit of increase, 10 years, 15 years, that much higher. We're on the rise. And we're not, and why I've been calling this out is we're still managing health care like we were 2 decades ago, right? The same models of offices. You know, we're not rethinking how we're creating healthcare.
Yeah. So that brings me to my next question, which is I know that you and Michael Dowling, the CEO of Northwell Health, recently wrote a book entitled The Aging Revolution. What's revolutionary about aging and what was the impetus for writing that book?
You know, I want to give Michael Dowling incredible credit. The story is that he called me one day and said, could you give a presentation 1 hour long? You can bring whoever you want to discuss all the aging services in the healthcare system. And so we brought in some key colleagues. That 1 hour presentation ended up becoming 2 hours of a dialogue. And that became essentially the outline for the book. And what we talk about is the accomplishments over time that healthcare we've done. We talk about blood pressure, preventing injuries. We talk about when we live longer, the treatment options have increased, right? So there's polypharmacy. If somebody has diabetes, there's no less than potentially 4 medicines you could be on to manage your diabetes.
Right.
Polypharmacy, 5 meds or more, we know lead to difficulty keeping up with your treatment plan.
Yeah, we actually did a segment on polypharmacy with one of your colleagues, Phil Solomon, some time ago. Yeah, fascinating.
And we're making really complex treatment plans if you're seeing all these specialists. So that's one issue that we have to understand. Our reliance on family caregivers to do the care plans we as physicians are recommending. What happened is 2 decades ago, if you're hospitalized, you were probably in the hospital a week or two. Today, it's like 2-5 days. That's unheard of to stay more than a week unless it's really complex situation.
And you're not in great shape when you get out.
No. And the families have to really be there to help. The next trend that's happening, nursing homes are shrinking. The availability, as this population increases, the healthcare delivery is being cut shorter. The access to these types of care, like nursing home beds, is shrinking. So we're relying on families without their involvement or preparation. So this is like a calling out. What are we doing? We have to really support our family caregivers and access to care. The need for doctors in the community, primary care, hospitals that can manage multiple functional needs, we're not set up for that. And so we have to start shifting. And we're using a 4M framework. And I'm happy to
discuss that.
Okay. Well, I'm going to give you a chance to do that, but I want to just sort of summarize what you said, and maybe we can use both of those as a framework for our continued conversation. So I heard you talk about the challenges that this success has led to, really, right? Is stress on caregivers, meaning family and non-paid individuals, the medical challenge of dealing with multiple medical conditions and the complexity of treating even one medical condition these days.
Right.
The physical infrastructure, you mentioned doctor's offices aren't set up to deal with elderly patients necessarily and so on. And then just the simple access to care, maybe not so simple, more patients requiring more complicated care, stressing out the healthcare system.
And we're seeing it today.
Yeah.
Trying to get a specialty appointment. I'm hearing follow-ups are 3 months, 6 months, a year.
Oh, well, I hear it from all my friends. I'm sure you do, too. You know, I get calls all the time. Can you help me get to see fill in the blank? And so I give them a name, and then they come back and say, well, thanks a lot. Their next available is 6 months from now.
Exactly.
Right.
There's been a rise in advanced care practitioners, which is a positive step, nurse practitioners, physician assistants, to ease that burden. But it's a change. People are looking for the Dr. Nashes of the world to take care of them.
Yeah. You said you had a framework for addressing those issues, or maybe a different set of issues. So tell me about that.
Yeah. The Institute for Healthcare Improvement has come out with the age-friendly framework. It's evidence-based. It's a compilation of all the studies that were out there, and they bundled them into the four M's. And that is mentation, screening individuals, and managing and identifying dementia, delirium, depression, medications, avoiding potentially harmful medicines in older adults because your physiology changes, you have to be careful with certain meds, mobility, trying to keep people as mobile and safe as possible, and then what matters most. Mm. When we talk about caring for somebody or having multiple conditions, sometimes treating one situation or disease can affect another illness negatively, and that can be distressing for patient, family, and even the clinician. So what matters most to the patient? Do you want to be pain-free, or do you want to be clear-minded, right? I use that example.
Yeah.
Some people are like, I'll be willing to be in more pain because I want to think clearly. You know, you have to make kind of judgments. So
So I'm trying to apply those four things, just to repeat, the mentation, medication, mobility, and what matters most. How do those align with the challenges that I kind of repeated back that you mentioned? So how do we achieve those four things in a world where we have problems of access, we have people with multiple medications, we have the complexity of medical treatment, et cetera, et cetera?
I think starting, and we've seen this in our health system because we are leaning into the what matters most to individuals.
Mm-hmm.
We're using goals of care conversations. What do we hope to accomplish? What matters most to an individual? And that helps us align the medications, keep people safe and mobile. If we're assessing their memory, it helps everybody understand, because sometimes we manage diseases without having the holistic picture. And one of the diseases that people with longevity, where as we get, we're able to treat heart, pulmonary, kidney diseases, we're seeing an increase in dementia.
Mm-hmm.
And a lot of times in healthcare, we're not necessarily managing or treating the dementia, but it's complicating all of the other issues. So it helps address what we call geriatric syndromes or syndromes. It's not owned by a specialist, right? So the polypharmacy, the delirium, the memory, and mobility are important to living. But if we build practices that have ramps, easy access, more disability friendly, we build phone systems that are easier for people with hearing, vision, or difficulty accessing, we sometimes build our healthcare systems for you and I, not for someone in need.
Yeah. No, that's a really interesting observation. As you were describing that, I was kind of mentally thinking about my own clinical office and how patients access trying to get an appointment with me. And
it's not easy.
It's not that easy.
It's not easy. Press this number, then
right.
Then there's 10
the numbers.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah. they're calling somebody who's not in the office. They can't clarify the question. Do you want to call back?
Yeah, and increasingly, I guess we're telling people to do this online, right?
Right.
Use the portal, message me, email, whatever, and that may be inaccessible for people who are not computer literate or who find that whole thing kind of challenging.
It can be overwhelming.
So how do you fix that?
You know, this is the fight I'm trying to say. We have to build systems for the most challenged and disability friendly.
Yeah.
So it's advocacy.
It's advocacy. Yeah. You know, it also reminds me that, you and I have known each other for a number of years, and I know you have a history not just in medical care and medical administration, but in public health. So how much of this is something that needs to be done not just by a health system or a healthcare provider like Northwell, but how much of this is enlisting government or changing the way we operate as a society?
It's a lot of that. It's going to be advocacy. It's going to be grassroots. It's going to be the family caregivers. I remember, if I could just tell a story, my mother had dementia, but she also had diabetes for most of her life. And I knew she had dementia when she used to be so meticulous about managing her diabetes. Mm. And then one day she just couldn't figure out how much insulin to give herself. And that was a major change. And that was a hint that she was having some difficulties.
Yeah.
A few years later, the dementia is clearly identified. I go to an endocrinologist. She wasn't able to do it herself. And I had to say to the endocrinologist, we can't do the insulin four times a day. She was like, but we need to manage the disease.
But that gets back to what's most important,
yeah.
right?
And it was most important that my mother not go to a nursing home where they might have been able to give the insulin. But we wanted to keep her home where one of us or someone else could be taught to give it. But maybe we could decrease it to twice a day, not four times a day, and have a different approach. Finally, we created a care plan, but that took advocacy. And it was uncomfortable for the clinicians because she knew to ideally manage the diabetes was this way.
Yeah.
But then she understood, okay, we're going to try what mattered most to keep my mother home.
Right. It does get back to the way that a lot of doctors in what are decidedly fractured healthcare system concentrate on, right? So the cardiologist is treating the heart disease and wants to do this, that, and the other thing. The gastroenterologist is treating the whatever it is, the bowel problem, and the pulmonologist is treating something else. And that's how you get into these problems with polypharmacy and with people losing the forest for the trees.
But my sister, who when she would go to the doctor's appointments, would be treated a little differently, and she wasn't able to push back like I was because I know healthcare.
Well,
right?
And you're an expert in this area.
And she felt like she was failing. So we have to learn to work with patients, families, what matters most, without making people feel like they're doing the wrong thing. We're all just trying to do the best we can. These are unique times. We've never managed so many illnesses together at once for so many people. These are really unheard of times.
I think there are a couple of important lessons there, perhaps, for people who might be listening to our conversation. So what would you say to somebody who is maybe struggling, as your family was at the beginning of your mother's decline, to feel like they're still doing the right thing? How do you help them shift that mindset? What kinds of questions should they be asking themselves or their caregivers or the doctors?
I think setting certain goals, like what is the goal here? What is your priority? Is it to be pain-free, comfortable, dignified, functioning? You know, like just asking questions, what are the goals? That helps develop a care plan. We try to educate patients and families that they have a say. They can ask questions. They can advocate for what sits right. Because we also know if we create a care plan, a treatment plan that isn't going to be done, it's a failed treatment plan and they'll be in the hospital.
Right.
And nobody wants that.
Yeah.
So we have to have this honest dialogue. But the problem is that often takes time and the systems are still 15-minute visits in the office.
Yeah.
We're going to have to show that by spending more time and adjusting the plan of care the right way, we are preventing hospitalization or emergency department visits. there are evidence-based models that are out there that we know of that help patients and families when they're in this state of complexity.
Yeah, well, you know, as you were speaking, I was thinking that I had asked you the question about what families can do and loved ones, but it's obviously also, there's got to be some reorientation from the provider side too, right? Tell me what the Aging Institute is all about and how you're reaching out to other clinicians to engage them in this kind of reorientation.
So we have four main priorities. We're calling them collaboratives because these are working with all departments across our health system. One is the age-friendly health system, focusing on the four M's, educating our teams, our clinicians, interdisciplinary teams on those four M's that we mentioned. The second one is advocating for the creation of more clinical care models, meaning evidence-based models of care in the community, putting social workers in offices to help cardiologists that have any complex care to help their families access resources or talk with them. So we're having a strategic plan about improving the clinical care models that we know exist and where we can place them throughout our system. The third one is memory care. With the celebration of longevity, an unintended consequence is an increase in dementia. People are living with dementia because they're not having the heart attacks that they used to have, or they're making it through pneumonia, for example. So how do we address, identify memory care, support patients, families from diagnosis to treatment through to end of life with memory disorders? And then the fourth area is family caregivers. These are unique times. Families don't have experience of seeing this with their grandparents.
This is new.
This is all new. So if you feel like you don't know what you're doing, it's probably because you've never had an experience or seen it. We don't know where to access healthcare resources for personal care, aides. How do you do it? Family caregivers want support, they want education, and they want link to resources. Unfortunately, the times we're at right now, that may be shrinking as well. We're advocating.
Yeah, I see the need for all of these things. I also am feeling a little bit like you have a really big job. This is not going to be a simple hill to climb.
No, this is not a specialty. No one's owning this. This is everybody. I mean, this is signage in our streets, the walkways, ramps.
Right. Well, that gets to the public health part, not just the,
If you look at some of our hospitals, just parking is not easy. But we've been creating valet services, free valet service to help individuals who are visiting their loved ones who may have difficulty crossing over from the parking lot into the main entrance. So it's a whole mindset that we are having strategic planning for. The good news is the evidence is there that we know what to do. We are measuring everything that we're going to do and measure its outcomes, because if we're not impacting patients, families, or clinicians, then we just can't waste our efforts.
This is fascinating, and I'm so glad that you joined me today to talk about this. Obviously, we've only been able to kind of scratch the surface of what is an enormous social, medical, economic change here. So if people wanted to find out more about all of the things that you just mentioned that you and your colleagues are doing, and that perhaps they could do, where can they turn for information?
Our book, The Aging Revolution, is available at most bookstores online, Amazon, for example, and that outlines a lot of what we discuss. The Institute for Healthcare Improvement leads the age-friendly health system. There are some family caregiver organizations like the Rosalind Carter Institute for Caregiving, the National Caregiving Alliance, who are advocates. Ask for age-friendly care.
And so become an advocate yourself.
Yeah. And then reach out, mcarney@northwell.edu. Join our revolution.
Well, and that was going to be my last question. So one is providing people with information, but I'm sure there are people listening who would also like to help.
Yes.
So how can they help? How can they help make your life a little easier, make the life of older people in America easier? What can they do?
We're looking for support. We're looking for organizations that we can align with to share this message.
We'll provide a link to that number in our show notes.
Great.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. I think this has been a fascinating conversation about a really important topic that's going to touch more and more of us as time goes on, and I appreciate your coming back.
Oh, thanks for always having me. Thank you.
My guest has been Dr. Maria Carney. She is the inaugural director of the Institute for Aging and Northwell Health and a professor of medicine at the Zucker School of Medicine. Thanks also to our editor, Ed Lee, to our producer, Lois Bentivegna, and our audio engineer, John Mullen. For more information about this particular program and to find all of our past episodes, please visit our website at medicine.hofstra.edu/wellsaid. You can also subscribe to our free podcast wherever you get your podcasts. Our listeners are welcome to send their comments, suggestions, and questions to wellsaid@hofstra.edu. Until next time, I'm Dr. Ira Nash, and that's Well Said.